Let's pray here. Father, as we are going into this last week, I know these students have much on their minds, and I know there's a lot of work ahead, there's a lot of stress and pressure at the end, and Father, we would again avail ourselves of the peace that is offered in Christ, who says that he has a rest that he offers to us, and that his burden is light. And I would pray that these students would know that light burden of serving their Lord Jesus, even in these last couple of weeks of class. Father, I would also ask that you be glorified in that what we do today, for we ultimately desire to be your servants. For you have given your Son to us. You have given all that we have. You have given us a hope of eternal life. You have given us the privilege of calling you Father. You have given us the privilege of availing ourselves of the confidence of your redemption and of the justification we have in Christ, as your servant Paul has taught. You have given us the privilege of belief and of the instruction that we have in Scripture, including the instruction we have in your servant John. And all of this we would desire to understand better, that we might glorify you more in our ministry. We pray that you would use this class to that end, in your wonderful name. Amen. Okay, let's see. Before I start formally, you have had a few days with the final study guide, and again, there's some extra copies back there behind Patrick in case any of you didn't have a copy of that. I did post it on the web, but I forgot to do it until yesterday. So thankfully, somebody reminded Jerry, and Jerry reminded me. So if you want a web, you want an electronic copy of that, it's available on Portal. Do you guys have any questions about that study guide or anything like that? Obviously, if we don't get to something in class, possibly, for instance, the book of James or Hebrews, then it won't be on the test. Or if it is on the test, we'll strike that question. So you can trust me on that. But everything else that we've covered in class is, of course, open season.
Yeah.
Are you thinking of the names like Borncombe and
Schmidt, Rebellion?
Yeah. I quickly mentioned in class last time, at the very beginning when I distribute this, that those, that first, the Debelius list, let me make sure I have the right one in front of me. The Schmidt, Debelius, Bultmann one, it says form critics, and Gunter, the Borncombe, Konzelman, Markson one is redaction critics. Really, all you need to know at this stage is that they were, one group was form critics, the other was redaction critics, and you should be able to recognize the list of names next to it. Yeah. These are very famous names, and they're often cited, and so it helps to know a little bit of their methodology as they're cited, so that you can understand kind of where they're coming from. Yeah.
On the reading, do we need to do the major themes from the entire semester, or just from the midterm of each?
Technically, it's from the midterm on, but one thing that you should be prepared to do is lad on John, on Paul, and any of the general epistles in Revelation. So John, Paul, and then kind of the rest, the last third of the New Testament. Okay? So anything that lad has to do with that, you should pay a special attention to. Okay? So the one thing that might, I can't remember the reading schedule, but especially the lad readings on John, or something that I would test here that I'm not sure technically came after the midterm. So. Did everybody hear that? Lad on John, Paul, and the last third of the New Testament. Anything else? I have written the exam, and it will be my recollection is that it's 20 multiple choice questions, and then it's, I think, 7, it might be 6 short answer questions. So it's very identical to what you saw on your midterm, and that'll give you some sense of it. I think you could finish it, like with the midterm, you can finish it in an hour and 15 minutes. So I don't think it should take you over long. On the other hand, one is always wise to show up at the beginning of the exam hour instead of towards the end, because you know, again, some of you are new, but if the exam hour, let's see, we've got a list here. The first exam hour starts Friday afternoon at 2:30 and it ends at 5:30. At 5:30, everybody has to clear the room. So if you started the exam at 5 o'clock, you get 30 minutes. Whereas if you started at 2:30, you have 3 hours. So showing up at the beginning of the exam hour is always a wise thing. I've proctored these exams before, so I know what happens. I mean, you get people with their study sheets sitting outside, waiting till the last second, thinking, okay, it'll take me 1 hour and 1 minute to do the exam. So, you know, 1 hour and 2 minutes, they put the study sheet away, rush in, go take the exam. And, I mean, if that's how you take a test, fine, but I recommend against it. Okay. Anything else?
Was the diatessaron?
The diatessaron, yeah, sure.
I have it as a continuous harmony. Was there an attempt to put it in a chronological order, too?
Yeah, it's a harmonization of the four Gospels, diatessaron, through four, the diatessaron. And so it takes the four canonical Gospels and harmonizes them and does attempt to do so in roughly a chronological order. It's one of the first major attempts at harmonizing the Gospels. Yeah. And who did it? Do you know? Tatian. Very good. Anything else?
South Galatian theory. Have we not gotten to that?
We haven't gotten to the South Galatian theory yet. That's Paul, which we hope to get to today.
Most of the lab reading had to do with the pastoral epistles. It really didn't talk about Galatians and Ephesians. It's like that, not the assigned parts anyway. Are you saying that you want us to read the
honest? I think you're maybe thinking of the Carson, New, and Morris reading was in the pastoral epistles. Is that right? The lad reading is on the theology of Paul, and so it's much broader than that. The Carson, New, Morris reading on the pastoral epistles has to do with if there was a... We'll see as we get into Paul today that some people have doubted Paul's authorship of some of the letters that are in the canon under the name of Paul. And the toughest case there is the pastoral epistles. So if you're prepared to read and interact with the pastoral epistles case in terms of arguing for Pauline authorship of the pastoral epistles, then you can take on anything. And so that's why I had you read just that selection of Carson, New, and Morris, because it gives you a sense of the kind of argumentation that would be employed in all the other books. Yeah.
Does that, on the one you said, identify occasions and purposes of each of Paul's letters?
That's today.
That's we'll talk about today. Today.
Everything about Paul is today. Okay, so, yeah.
What do you think how would you interact with the contention that early Christians were extremely naive about believing in miracles? Like,
What I'm looking for there is on the last page or two of the resurrection handout that I distributed, there is, I think the section is titled The Early Christians Were Not Dupes. And so if you just look through there, an ability to kind of assert some of those things in your own words, that's what I'm looking for. Okay? Is it on the last page or second? Second to last page? Yeah, okay. That's good. All right. Well, very good. I'll give you an opportunity at the beginning of the next class period to air any other questions or grievances that you have. That'll be fine. All right. We were, where we left last time, we were talking about John and Ioannine theology. And I had argued that the authorship of the Ioannine literature, namely the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and the book of Revelation, all of that is written by John. And in order to do so, I interacted in bit with Papias and the way that Eusebius, in my mind, misinterprets Papias. And that's what we had covered last time. We had also noted that there are a couple of explicit purpose statements, especially in the Gospel of John and also in 1st John. What I'd like to do in this hour is, maybe this half hour, optimally, since we do need to get to Paul, is to If somebody came to me and said, what are the three or four things I really need to know in order to interpret John correctly? That's what I want to do. I want to give you guys kind of interpretive keys. I've mentioned before that my goal here is not to give you an overview of the whole of the Gospel or the Book of Revelation or any of the other works of John. That is done in a class we call Bible Content Overview or Bible Content Survey. And some of you have to take the Bible Content exam. And so if you pass the exam, you're already prepared in that regard. If you haven't, or if you're feeling a need to kind of understand again some of the basic essences of each of these books, that's Bible Content Overviews for that. The way I see this class and the way I want it to function here as we talk about John and Paul especially is what should I constantly have in the back of my mind as I'm interpreting John? What should I have constantly in the back of the mind as I'm interpreting Paul? So it's kind of interpretive keys as you go in. And there are certain keys that I think are important as you understand the Gospel of John. First of all, has to do with its structure, and then we're going to look at the intended audience, and that's going to take us into the discussion of believe in the Gospel of John. And then I'm also interested in the portrayal of Jesus there. Now, the structure of the Gospel of John, roughly speaking, you have a prologue, which is chapter 1, verses 1 through 18, and you have kind of an epilogue. Did I spell that correctly? Epilogue. Which is chapter 21 of the Gospel. And then in between, you have kind of the meat of the Gospel. Okay? Let me give you an example of that. Chapter, you guys will, of course, recognize that the whole bit at the beginning of the Gospel, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, takes us through to verse 18. And then finally we start getting into the narrative, okay? He's kind of setting you up with the cosmic perspective of what's going on. There is a Word, He is God. There is a witness to that Word, He is John the Baptist. And then the Word becomes incarnate. That's the kind of the big cosmic overview. And then he launches into what John the Baptist actually said. So that's the prologue. The epilogue has to do with the end of John. There's a sense in which after Thomas sees Jesus and actually believes in him, that there's almost this kind of concluding sentence. Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. And there's a nice kind of concluding feeling to that. And then he goes on. After these things, Jesus manifested himself again to his disciples in Tiberias. And you have the reinstitution of Peter and a specific statement, too, about the disciple whom Jesus loved, basically, and the question as to whether he'll die or not. Okay. Now, there's a sense in which you kind of feel like, okay, the Gospel's ended in chapter 20, but then there's this concluding epilogue, if you would, and that's what I say about that. Now, some people have gone so far as to say that it's as if you don't need the prologue and the epilogue, and maybe they were added later. I don't think that's what's going on. Certainly the prologue, okay, chapter 1, verses 1 through 18, a lot of the concepts that arise there, the discussion of light and darkness, even the incarnation of the Word, although the word, logos in Greek, doesn't appear elsewhere in the Gospel with that exact meaning. It has other meanings. But the incarnation aspect of who this person is, that this is God incarnate, then also is signaled repeatedly throughout the rest of the Gospels, throughout the rest of the Gospel of John, in various incarnate ways, the way that Jesus has these I am sayings, I am such and such, I am such and such, and even just I am, which is, as you may know, effectively the name for the deity coming out of the Old Testament. And especially the way that the section in this whole center part in chapter 20 ends with the proclamation of Thomas falling at the feet of Jesus and saying, and then the Greek says, saying, to him. He says to Jesus. He speaks to Jesus and says, my Lord, my God, looking at Jesus. And so you have an explicit statement of deity at the end of the gospel, just like you do in the prologue. So what I'm saying is that we could work through this, but the themes in the prologue are then picked up elsewhere in the gospel, which shows that the prologue was intentional and coheres very nicely with the rest of the gospel. The issue with regard to the epilogue in chapter 21 is this kind of slapped on at the end. Well, there's a sense in which the verses that I read from chapter 20, you know, many signs, other signs, therefore Jesus also performed. And then the statement, you know, I've written these things in order that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, feels like a nice conclusion, but it's not a necessary one. It's a statement of purpose of the book, but that doesn't mean that that's all that there is to say about the book. And in point of fact, the author seems very interested in reinstating Peter, because you'll remember that, you know, Peter is asked three times whether he loves Jesus, right? And then he's each time said to shepherd my sheep or take care of my flock. Well, of course, earlier in the gospel, Jesus denies Peter, Peter denies Jesus three times. So you have a very clear structural reinstatement of Jesus. Goodness, I'm getting all tangled. Jesus didn't need to be reinstated. Reinstatement of Peter that parallels very nicely what went earlier in the gospel. And then there's this question of tension coming out of the beloved disciple and who he is, and apparently a tension during the time he wrote that some people thought he's not going to die. And he wants to make sure to clarify in chapter 21 that that's not what Jesus said. Okay? So although there's a sense in which it ends in 20, the stuff in the epilogue coheres very nicely with the stuff that came before. So the whole gospel fits well together, if you would. Now, in terms of the center section of the gospel, the rest of chapter 1 through chapter 11, and the rest of chapter 12, well, and then chapter 12 through 20, are often divided that in those ways. In particular, in these first 11 chapters, Jesus presents seven signs, and he also makes the I am sayings. Okay? And that seems to cohere. So people will speak of this as the book of the seven signs, as if it's, you know, kind of the first half is about the seven signs. And then the material that comes afterwards, as if it's the action leading up to the crucifixion and resurrection, as well as Jesus' kind of last prolonged instructions to his disciples. That's what you have in kind of the latter half of the book. Now, I think roughly speaking, this structure works well. However, can I note that there are not just seven signs in the book Gospel of John? The seven signs are the seven miracles, starting with the miracle of changing of water to wine in Cana. There is an eighth sign in the gospel, and it's very important that you recognize it, and that is the death and resurrection of Jesus. The resurrection of Jesus functions as a sign, such that when Jesus appears and Thomas says, my Lord and my God, and he talks to him about, because you have seen me, you have believed, blessed are those who do not see and yet believe. The next thing was that passage I've now quoted twice. Here comes number three. Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of his disciples. In other words, from the point of view of the gospel, Jesus' resurrection appearance was a sign that he is who he claims he is. And then in this first book, where he does present a lot of signs and the I am sayings, they mutually confirm each other. In particular, the signs prove that what Jesus says about himself, I am the truth, I am the light, I am the door, I am the resurrection, those famous sayings, are proved by the actions that he does. So when he raises Lazarus from the grave, the whole point is he has just told them, I am the resurrection. And he proves the point that he is the resurrection. So the signs confirm who Jesus is. So in many ways, the whole gospel is about who Jesus is, which is, of course, true of all the gospels, but it's also very true of this. Okay? So those are some comments on the structure of the Gospel of John. Right? Next. The intended audience of the Gospel of John, and I'm going to kind of weave this in with point three as well, believe in the Gospel of John, what it means to believe. Now, I just read to you, in fact, I'm going to ask that you guys turn to chapter 20 of the Gospel of John. I just read to you this very important passage about Thomas. And what is it that Jesus is after with Thomas? All right? The narrative all has to do with belief. So that when... what is Thomas's issue? Well, Thomas wasn't there when Jesus appeared. You know the narrative. Thomas wasn't there when Jesus appeared. Thomas is there, and he says, the other disciples tell him that they've seen the risen Lord. And Thomas's response is, unless I shall see in his hands, I'm in verse 25, and the imprint of the nails, and put my finger into the place of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not, what? Believe. So the issue is, he won't believe unless he sees it. After 8 days, Jesus shows up, says, peace be with you, verse 27. Then he said to Thomas, reach here your finger and see my hands, and reach here your side and put it into my side, and be not unbelieving, but be believing. The whole point is to create faith in Thomas. Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. Jesus' response, and this is about you and I, is, because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who did not see and yet believed. Anybody here seen the risen Lord? You don't have to raise your hand if you have. Most of us have not. Well, at least you'll grant me that. You are more blessed than Thomas. That's the point. Because your faith is in a context where you didn't actually have to physically see him and hold on to him. There's a sense in which Thomas's faith is not up to where yours is, effectively. And you see these kind of gradations in belief that's even assumed there. The ones who don't need to see are more blessed than the ones who need to see in order to believe. And in point of fact, it's then in that context that he says, these things are written to you in order that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. So that's the context of the point of belief. Now, I was going to point out to you, and pointed out to you last time, that belief here then is not a light switch, was the terminology I used, but is more of a rheostat. There's degrees of belief in the Gospel of John. And if you want an illustration of that, you can go to chapter 11 of the Gospel. And you have this whole series of people who are at different stages of faith in the Gospel. The initial context is that of Lazarus, and Lazarus is dead, and Martha and Mary are extremely sad because this is their brother. So Jesus hears about this in verse 3. Lord, behold, the one whom you love is sick. But Jesus heard it. When he heard it, he said, the sickness is not to death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified by it. So he's expecting to be glorified by this. And so having heard that this great comrade and friend of his is sick, he sits around for a couple of days. And he waits until the guy is good and dead and buried in a tomb before he shows up. Then he says, it's time to go. So he says, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, verse 11, showing that Jesus knew that by waiting around, Lazarus was going to kick the big celestial bucket and end up in a tomb. All right, so Jesus knew what he was doing when he waited around. Then he shows up. Jesus says plainly, Lazarus is dead, verse 14, because the disciples are kind of clueless. They're like, huh? Well, if he's sleeping, you know, what's the big deal? He's dead, folks, okay? And then he shows up. Now, verse 15, Lazarus is dead, verse 14, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him. Now, wait a second. These are the disciples who have given of their lives, have followed Jesus around, have heard his I am sayings. Repeatedly throughout the gospel, there's groups that are said to believe. The disciples are clearly of that, and yet somehow this resurrection of Lazarus is supposed to help them believe, but they already believe. Well, effectively, what I think is going on there is Jesus has taken the rheostat, where they're at in their belief, and he's cranking it up a few notches, making it a little brighter so that they believe even more and understand even more who he is. All right? When you show up with Martha and Mary, Martha comes to him and says, she's quite distraught. Jesus says to her, your brother shall rise again. Martha said to him, verse 24, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Well, that's belief. It's belief that the resurrection will occur on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. There's the I am saying. It's going to be proved by his miracle. But I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? Belief. You see, it's all about belief again. And she said to him, yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world. Martha is already a person of faith, and yet there is a sense in which her faith is not appropriate yet to the context. Mary runs to him, and he weeps with her. And then we get to verse 39. Remember, Martha is the one who has believed, and what has she believed about Jesus, by the way? Not just great man. But I believe you're the Christ, the Son of the God, the one who comes into the world. I mean, all of that, that's high Ioannine Christology. She believes the stuff that one needs to believe about the Messiah. That's who Martha is in verse 27. We get to verse 39. Jesus says, remove the stone. Martha, the same person who just professed her belief, the sister of the deceased said to him, Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he's been dead for 4 days. He's going to stink. Jesus said to her, did I not say to you, if you believe, you will see the glory of God? And so they removed the stone, and Jesus raises his eyes, and he says, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. Sorry, this is the New American Standard. They like these and thous, all right? And I know that thou hearest me always. They also like hearest. But because of the people standing around, I said it, that they may believe that thou didst send me. And he says, Lazarus, come forth. Now, the result, verse 45, many, therefore, of the Jews who had come to Mary and beheld what he had done, believed in him, but some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. And then the thing the Pharisees are concerned about, verse 48, if we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him. I mean, how many times can John mention the word believe in a single narrative? Do you get the point? You know, but do you also see that there's a variety of characters that are represented in that? And often in interpreting the Gospels, especially the Gospel of John, it's helpful to see ourselves in the characters with whom Jesus is interacting and understand that we're supposed to identify in various ways with them or not identify with them, depending on who they are. And in this narrative, you have the Pharisees who don't believe. They refuse to believe, even though he raises people from the dead. You have people in the crowds, some of whom run off to the Pharisees and tell them what happened. Others of whom clearly believe because it says they believe, but they only believe because they see it. You have Martha, who already professes belief, but she needs it cranked up a little bit to really believe that Jesus can do exactly in that moment what he says he can do, because he really is the resurrection and life. And do you see then that there's this whole range, if you would, of belief in the narrative, and in each instance, what Jesus is trying to do is to take people where they're at and increase their belief a little bit more. If that is the case, then what is the intended audience of the Gospel of John? It's not just unbelievers, but it's everybody who follows Christ or is who interested in Christ. Because all of us need to be challenged again with who Jesus is. This is the guy that if he came right now to earth, and one of us has recently had a deceased brother, he could come up and say, I'm going to raise him from the dead. Right now. That's who Jesus is. That's the kind of power he has. And that proves that he is the resurrection and the life, and thus the final resurrection and eternal life is in his hands at this point in time. And we need to believe that in the deepest parts of our soul. And that's hard to believe sometimes, especially when you face death. And many of you guys are young, and you've not really faced death yet. But when you sit next to a corpse, as I have done, what is your response in that moment? Well, the response is ultimately to be, Jesus is the resurrection and the life. And that's where the rubber really meets the road. Okay? So that's the intended audience. In other words, you are the intended audience. In other words, even though John speaks simply, and he uses simple Greek, and he repeats himself a whole lot, especially about belief, it's for you. So read it again and again and again. And so forth. Now, can I also note that some of the other aspect of the intended audience is he plunges right into the gospel with the prologue, right? In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. Just pretend for a second that you haven't heard that dozens, if not hundreds or thousands of times before. Pretend for a second that this is the first time somebody comes and says this to you. And here's the opening of the book. In the beginning was the Word. What's your initial response? What's a word? And the Word was with God. Okay? And the Word was God. What's your response? How in the world can a word be a God? He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being by him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. What's a light of men? What's a life? How can a person be life? And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not comprehended it. What I would challenge you to do, again, is to read through the Gospel of John as if you never knew it. And just see how often things come up in the gospel that fundamentally your initial reaction should be, and I would argue should properly be, huh? What in the world are you talking about, John? And then to realize that later in the gospel, Jesus is the resurrection and the life, illustrated by the resurrection. He is the light of the world. Light, you know. So this all comes back again, and the whole thing coheres. But there's a sense in which you are not prepared to read the prologue of John until you've read the whole Gospel of John. So this is kind of, in my mind, it's like movies today, you know. Movies go so fast today because, in part, they're wanting you to buy the DVD, you know, so that you'll watch it again just so you can catch up on the stuff that you didn't get before. Well, John's like that in spades. Because you read through it, and it's just so shocking initially that it takes multiple reads before you start getting really what's going on in some of the complexities of the gospel. And that's another argument that the intended audience here is not naive unbelievers, although certainly them, but it's also people who have been Christians for all their lives, maybe, and need to read the gospel again as if for the first time. Right. So there's some comments on the intended audience and belief in John. And obviously the question that all this raises is, who is Jesus? That's what he starts off with. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Well, who is this Word? I mean, he's starting you with a question, effectively, by starting you with a statement that's supposed to cause you to think, who is this man? And that's effectively what's going on again and again. And with the seven signs and the I am sayings, he is supporting the proposition that the Word was God, and what that means and all of its implications for our life. And the implications when he says, I am the way and the truth and the life, no one comes to the Father but through me. We've got one access to God the Father, and that's through God the Son. And that's the challenge of the gospel. Okay? If you go to the gospel with that mindset, then I think you'll find it exciting to read. Instead of going, oh yeah, I know that, go again as if, you know, blank slate, and let it challenge you and rock your categories, because that's in a sense what the gospel is supposed to do. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about the Gospel of John. Anybody have any questions or thoughts?
Maybe I missed it. Did you say the purposes of the second and third epistles of John and the Revelation?
No, I really didn't talk about the purposes of those. And they're not going to be in the exam, in case you're wondering about that. The purposes in second and third John have a lot more to do with interacting with heresies, specific heresies that are going on in the church, and warning people not to be hospitable to those who are fundamentally heretics. And then the book of Revelation has a lot of purposes, and we'll talk about some of the keys of that in a moment. Yeah.
I think by the passage in John 20:31, where he says many other things that he's written, he could write more. I think by John writing that, he's saying that less is better. I mean, so often we have today tons of books written where John has spent 3 years at least with Christ. He
yeah.
writes 25 pages.
Yeah. Well, I think, Brad, I mean, your question is less better in that context when he says many other things I could have written. Yes, there's a sense in which he's saying, I have been selective, and what I've selected is for a purpose of producing belief. And not just belief, but belief in Jesus, that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. So it's belief, but it's also who Jesus is. That's the basis of his selection. But he's also acknowledging that there's a lot more that Jesus did. The real question that comes out of this, and some of the church fathers had the idea that John knew the other canonical gospels, possibly all three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but at least one of them, and intentionally included in his gospel the stuff that they didn't include. And thus he says many other things could be said, but I've selected some material that you need to know about in order to produce belief. And that's possible as well. But certainly it's acknowledging that, you know, in John you have 3 years of Jesus' ministry. In the other Gospels you have basically a year. In 3 years of his ministry he did a lot more than John's telling us about. So Jesus, in effect, he's also trying to say Jesus is even more amazing than I was able to represent in just 21 short chapters. So, yeah. All right, let's talk about 1 John for a second. In our beginning Greek series, we read through 1 John in Greek. And so I've taught through 1 John a number of times. One of the things that is very striking when you go through 1 John is the guy keeps coming back to certain topics. The word walk appears repeatedly. The word love. I mean, he can't get over the love. You've already said that, John. I mean, we know we're supposed to love one another. Okay? We got that. But he says, he comes back to it kind of again and again. And issues of light and darkness and issues of how we conduct ourselves, all of that. The way I view the Gospel of John is I would hate to be asked on an exam, like an ordination exam or an exam in front of you, provide an outline of the Gospel of John. I have seen a variety of outlines of the Gospel of John, and inevitably, they are either too simple or too complex. They're either too simple that if you look at the, you know, the three parts that are in the outline, it doesn't adequately represent what's in each of the sections. Or they're too complex in that you've got so many levels of detail that there's just no way anybody can remember it. And the reason for that is that the way I see John writing in 1 John is, here's a theme, here's another theme that kind of goes alongside it. He kind of lets this one go for a while, and he comes back to another theme. Then he brings this one back in, and he kind of does this, and he brings this in, and it's all this. And the point is that the repetition of the themes is to make sure that when you leave the book, you really do have the idea we're supposed to love one another, you know, and that kind of thing. For love is from God, and he provides a variety of arguments all the way through. This is more similar to some forms of preaching that go on in some third world contexts, where the preacher will repeat themselves again and again, where the flow of logic is not A to Z, but it's A, B, A prime, B prime, C, A prime, B, C, C, A, B. You know, it just, you keep coming back to things so that by the time you finish, you get a feel for how one ought to conduct one's life instead of just kind of a single A to Z kind of logical sequence. And if you approach 1 John that way, then I think it frees you up to just enjoy why he's bringing it up again or why something else is coming again. And so if there was one key I would give you to reading 1 John, it would be that. Let him recapitulate his themes. Let him come up with things again and again. And enjoy that. It makes it difficult to preach through 1 John, honestly. Because either you have to take the book as a whole, or if you start breaking it down into certain chapters, you're going to realize that people are going to hear basically the same sermon for several weeks. Because the same topics are going to come up again. So another way to approach it is to go through 1 John topically and just take the love theme, then the walk theme, and the light and dark theme, and just take the themes through. So that's an issue that comes up. So anyway, in 1 John, recapitulation of themes, and a lot of the same purposes, basically, that you have in the Gospel of John. I mean, the essence of the Christian life and the import of belief and the import of love are found in both. Right. So that's what I was going to say about 1 John. All right. Well, I want to do the book of Revelation in about 10 minutes, so that's should be pretty straightforward. The book of Revelation is the book. If there was a book that people are most scared of reading in the New Testament, it's the book of Revelation. On the other hand, there are groups of people that are not scared of Revelation at all, and my response to them is you should be a lot more scared than you are. Because they are more confident of their interpretation of it than they should be. All right? But somewhere in between, I think, lies how we should approach the book of Revelation. If you're scared by it, don't be. If you aren't, do be. You know, somewhere in between. I'm trying to say, approach it with some more trepidation than you might, but not unwilling to read it. And again, I want to give you, I teach a whole class on, we go through four class periods in my General Epistles and Revelation class in Revelation, okay? So there's a lot that can be said. But if I was to boil it down to a few pieces of advice that will help get you into it, the first would be, these may not be where you would think of starting, but the book of Revelation is, in my mind, a mixed genre. People fight over whether the book of Revelation is an apocalypse. It's, after all, kind of coined the term, the apocalypse of John, the revelation of John. But whether it is an apocalyptic genre, which would then make it most similar to, for instance, the end of the book of Daniel, parts of Zechariah, all right? So certain Old Testament books like that, and then this whole Jewish genre of apocalyptic literature, some books that you've probably never read, and I'm not like asking you to run out and do it, but 1 Enoch, 4 Ezra, books like that, that have this kind of apocalyptic feel to it. Apocalyptic is effectively an unveiling of heaven, a permitting of somebody to go up into heaven, as is done in the book of Ezekiel, for instance, and seeing what is there. so that they can go back to earth and report that with the point of kind of heartening people into service and to know that ultimately we're going to win in the end. I mean, that's kind of the apocalyptic approach. Now, obviously, the book of Revelation does that. But there's also chapters 2 and 3, which have these so-called letters to the seven churches, right? Well, I don't think that's the proper way of speaking of chapters 2 and 3. There are not seven different letters in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is itself a letter. The whole book is a letter. So if you turn to the beginning of Revelation, Revelation 1:4, John, to the seven churches that are in Asia, grace to you and peace from him who is and was and who is to come and from the seven spirits who are before his throne. That is a modified but still typical address to a letter. John to the seven churches. John didn't write individual churches. He wrote seven churches all at once. He has specific things to say to each of the seven churches, and that's what he does in chapters 2 and 3. But they're not seven different letters. So this is a letter. And as such, he has an intent to the letter, and that is ultimately to encourage these people in their Christian walk, even in spite of the possibility of persecution, and also in spite of the way that they've been Christians for a while now, and they're kind of falling away from their first love, if you would. Okay. Now, if that's the case, then let me step back for a second. If Revelation is apocalyptic, then you have to understand it in some ways on analogy with the book of Ezekiel and Daniel, etc., in the apocalyptic genre, which is you have symbols that are represented as heavenly symbols that stand for things. Okay? And certainly you would recognize in the book of Revelation that that's the case. We've got symbols in the book of Revelation that are presented for us. And so you have to, at times, decode the symbols. That's true. At the same time, if the book of Revelation is an epistle, if it's a letter, then you have to understand that it has a purpose, and that is to address seven literal historical churches in the first century. So it's a very contextualized book. It speaks to a group of churches in Asia Minor in the first century, which means you need to understand the situations in those churches in order to rightly understand what's going on in the book. Thankfully, in chapters 2 and 3, you get hints of what he's particularly concerned about in those churches. Some are in danger of falling prey to the practice of the Nicolaitans, to a kind of heresy. Some have undergone persecution and will undergo more persecution, and they need to be reminded to overcome in the midst of that. Some have lost their first love, so that's it. If you remember those things, the facts of those seven churches, as then you go on in the rest of the book of Revelation, and you say, now let's see, if I was undergoing persecution, how would the rest of this book feel to me? Or, let's see, if I was in danger of being entrapped in heresy, how would the rest of the book of Revelation appear to me? Or if I had kind of allowed my love there's an issue as to what the love is, but let's say of the love of Christ to fade and to be entrapped more and more in the earthly possessions of the world that's around me, how would I read the book of Revelation then? And some suggestions would be, if I was undergoing persecution, the book of Revelation is going to say, you think persecution's bad now. You just wait. And you know what? There's a heavenly reward for those who endure persecution. For those who overcome, Jesus will establish them in the kingdom to come. So I'm going to stay with the persecution. I'm going to endure it. For those who are undergoing heresy, the rest of the book of Revelation is going to tell me that there is Jesus, and there's one right way to worship and follow Jesus, and there is satanic opposition that will attempt to lure away the church in the midst of the context it's in, and we dare not go that path, because where that ultimately ends up is literally in the pit. Whereas if we persevere and we overcome and we follow Jesus, we're secure in the end. If I am caught in the materialism of the world that is around me, I think this is perhaps the most applicable to the context of most Americans. If I am caught in the materialism of the world around me, realize that that is under the God of this age, and that God is failing, and that I need to be willing to forsake all in order to passionately follow Jesus, because the reward at the end is greater than any reward I'll find in the present. Right? So if you view the historical situations of the churches, then that gives you a lens from which to then read the rest of the book of Revelation. We need to read it as if we're in the first century, enduring what they're enduring, and then later apply it to our lives today. I think one of the great problems that people have with the book of Revelation is they skip that step of what did this say to people in John's day, and they immediately go to, okay, what does that mean to me today? And there's some extremes there. One extreme is to say, boy, I wonder if Gorbachev is 666. And I mean, I had that conversation across the table when we were raising financial support to go on staff with a college ministry. We had this wonderful couple who prayed a lot, et cetera, et cetera, and they were convinced that Gorbachev, and some of you are probably young enough to think Gorba who? But Gorbachev, who at the time was the leader of the Soviet Union, was the Antichrist. You know, obviously, you know, there's been misidentifications of those kind of figures throughout time. And that's because people too quickly rush to modern application instead of thinking of, let's view this book from the first century lens. All right? So that's one of the consequences of understanding the genre of epistle. The last aspect of that is this is intended to be prophecy. And it is intended to be prophetic in the sense of words of the old, similar to the prophetic books of the Old Testament, especially Ezekiel and Daniel that use the apocalyptic genre, so that the book ends by John saying, "Boy, I'm having a hard time with proper nouns today, aren't I?" But John says, "And if anyone takes away from the words of the book of this fill in the blank prophecy, God shall take away his part from the tree of life and from the holy city, which are written in this book." This is prophecy. So it does speak of the future, at least in some respects. Okay? So I have a predilection to viewing this as at least having some future referent. Second, prophecy is a lot more complex than we like to think. Okay? I tried to illustrate that towards the beginning of this class when we said, okay, let's look at prophetic statements about the Messiah, or prophetic statements about whether the Messiah will die or whether he'll be resurrected. And we had to acknowledge that there was a trajectory in the Old Testament that was heading in a certain direction, but exactly what it would look like in the end is a little hard to say. I may have used the illustration that came from Willem van Gameren, who's a very fine biblical theologian and is a very fine Old Testament scholar. I wrote a thesis under him. He argues, did I use the rose illustration? He's a Dutchman and he has a garden, right? And there's a rose that's planted there in the garden. And you know it's going to be a rose because you planted the rose. And you know it's going to come, but you don't know if it's going to go to the right or to the left, or maybe even the exact coloration of which flower is going to come out first, where the thorns are going to be, where the leaves are going to be. There's an exciting dynamic about gardening, which I'm not a great gardener, but he was a Dutchman. He loved gardening, so he would get into this. You know, that you would plant something, you know what it's going to be, and yet nature constantly is unexpected at the same time. So there's that wonderful thing of engaging in, I know and yet I don't know, and being surprised and enjoying the surprise in the process. I think if you view prophecy in those terms, then it also frees you up in a certain extent when you come to New Testament prophecy in the book of Revelation, that we have trajectories here. We know that there's going to come a point in time where Christ returns. And we also know that there's going to be a variety of persecutions that the church is going to undergo before that. But we don't know all the events and the times and the places and the hows and the whys. And I don't know that we absolutely have to know all that either. because really what in a sense matters with the book is the big picture. If I'm undergoing persecution, I need to overcome. And this gives me warrant to see overcoming as worthwhile. And that's effectively what's going on. So I'm arguing then that the mixed genre of apocalyptic calls us to look at the symbols. The epistolary genre calls us to look at the first century context. And the prophetic genre calls us to understand their trajectory, but also hold it a little bit loosely and not claim that I know that, you know, this particular aircraft constitutes something that's proclaimed in the book of Revelation. Charlie just asked if I see any issues with the churches being limited to Asia Minor and not Achaia or whatever. I think that's just John's context. We know he's off the coast in Patmos. He has connection to the church in Ephesus. He knows those churches. He knows their situation. And there's a sense in which Jesus reveals to him the specific kind of situation of the churches there, the ones to whom he naturally would minister. He's not just saying the persecuted in Asia Minor. One of the things that I would clarify with, he's not just saying the persecuted in Asia Minor, because if you read the seven churches in the book of Revelation, in chapters 2 and 3, there's at least two churches where there's no mention of persecution. So not all the churches seem to be undergoing persecution at this time. There is the danger that the church as a whole is going to undergo persecution, and that's certainly part of the book of Revelation. But not everyone's experiencing it, as far as I can tell, at least, in the book at this time.
But he calls himself a fellow sufferer.
Fellow sufferer. So the persecution is a major theme in the book. That's right. I've got a guy writing a master's thesis on this right now with me. And so persecution is huge in the book of Revelation, and that's important. By the way, I should say, have I said to you about persecution? Have I talked about persecution here? I teach Sunday school occasionally at Charlie's church here. Charlie administers the Sunday school classes. And the first Sunday school class I ever taught about 6 years ago when we first moved to town was a class on 1 Peter, because I really love the book of 1 Peter. You guys kind of know that now, right? Well, you know, 1 Peter talks a lot about suffering, doesn't it? And I found that to be a very difficult Sunday school class to teach in a West County fairly well-to-do church, where suffering is basically, for most people, it's kind of like, you know, people gave me the finger because of my Jesus bumper sticker, you know? Or it's more innocuous than that, you know? There were some people that kind of glared at me over coffee when I was at the office because they know that I follow Jesus, you know? So we don't understand what real suffering is in many respects. Compared to at least the rest of the church. And so trying to apply the book of 1 Peter in that context was a trick, okay? Now, after I taught 1 Peter, I thought, I'm going to pick a book that doesn't deal with suffering anymore. Because, I mean, literally, almost every Sunday school class, it was in the text, because I just go sequentially through the text, and so it's there. So it's kind of like, okay, we got to talk about suffering again, you know? So we talk about suffering again. So I said, okay, I'm going to pick Philippians. I mean, Philippians is a book about joy, isn't it? And right in the middle of the book of Philippians, there's all this suffering. And so I was stuck in my next Sunday school class talking about suffering. And I said, okay. I can't remember what I did right after that. I also eventually taught 2 Corinthians. I taught 1 and 2 Thessalonians. And I kept looking for a book that didn't have suffering in it. Because it was getting annoying. Because you can imagine, I get the same people in the Sunday school class time after time, and they're like, what is his hang up with suffering? You know? And yet, what I learned from that experience is that suffering is throughout the whole of the New Testament. Because the church is a persecuted church in some ways in the New Testament period. Not nearly as persecuted as it was about to be, but there's the beginning of some persecution there. The church worldwide as a whole undergoes persecution and suffering. And in many ways, we are inoculated to it in the New Testament, in America, I mean. And there is a phrase that I learned, I saw this one little quote that has stuck with me. I don't know the whole context in which it appears, but there's a famous German theologian named Helmut Thielicke. And Thielicke says, Americans have an inadequate theology of suffering. And that is so true. You want an example of it? Try and find a systematic theology or even a book on Christian ethics that has more than just a few pages. In fact, most of the systematic theologies won't even mention suffering as a theological theme. And yet it's a huge theme throughout the whole of the Old and New Testament, but especially in the New Testament. So we don't know, we don't have a theology of suffering, and the danger of that is if true suffering ever comes upon a Christian in America, they don't know what to do with it. And that's very dangerous. So one of the things I would challenge you guys to do is to be receptive to developing your kind of your own sense of how a Christian should approach suffering as you read through the New Testament. Okay? And that's something that is important. And it's very much part of the book of Revelation. I think one of the reasons that Americans end up speculating about tanks and helicopters when they come to the book of Revelation is they don't understand the context of suffering and persecution and how this immediately speaks to that in so many ways. So there's my little soapbox for this part of the hour. Four different interpretive approaches to understanding the book of Revelation. And basically what you will find is if you read any book on the book of Revelation, they will end up ultimately having to take one of these four positions. Okay? And so you should at least know what these positions are. They are mentioned as well in Ladd. Ladd covers these in his brief section on the book of Revelation, so it's there as well. Preterist is where the book of Revelation is fundamentally about events before and leading up to AD 70, the destruction of the temple. Okay? So the preterist will come to the book of Revelation and we'll read the bulk of the book of Revelation as a prediction of the kind of sufferings that the church and the people of God experienced leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem. And when Jerusalem is destroyed, there is a new age in which the church is now free, no longer bound by the temple and by Judaism, to proclaim. And that effectively is the millennium, is how many preterists will understand it. Okay, so the book is primarily about events coming up to that. The historicist approach will say that the book of Revelation is about the history of the church. Where you especially see this worked out is some people will argue that the seven churches that are mentioned in chapters 2 and 3 of the book of Revelation goes through sequentially kind of the history of the church. And so each church represented gives you maybe 200, 300 years in the life of the church. I find this a very improbable way to read the book. Because in my mind, when John was writing seven churches in Asia Minor and eventually it was distributed in Asia Minor, how would they read it except, he says Ephesus, we're in Ephesus, he must be talking about us. Instead of saying, he must be talking about the Reformation. You know, and the Counter-Reformation. This is, I think, an improbable way to read chapters 2 and 3 and less likely with the other. The idealist approach is that this is a book about ideas or about themes that will occur repeatedly throughout the history of the church. So you'll actually get some very fine commentators, for instance, who will say, what is the beast in the book of Revelation? Well, there's a variety of ways that the beast is described, and certainly the interesting thing is there are correlations to the historical situation in Rome. Okay, so they'll say on the first instance, the beast is Rome. It's the Roman opposition to the church. Okay. Then the question is, where else do you see opposition to the church? Well, you see opposition to the church in Albania today. You saw opposition to the church in Russia under the old Soviet Republic when atheism was officially endorsed. You see opposition to the church when in secular American society, the church is its back is against the wall. So what is the beast? Well, the beast is the theme or the idea of opposition to the church. And when do you have the beast? Anytime there's opposition to the church. So there's not just one beast in terms of application. Everything is a beast that enjoys some context of opposing the church. The last position is the futurist, and that holds that the book of Revelation is fundamentally predictive and looks to the future and expresses the tribulation that will lead up to the millennium, the thousand-year reign of Jesus. Whether that's symbolic for a thousand years or not is well, it'll be a literal thousand years or maybe more or less. You know, it's a different thing. There will be a thousand-year reign of Jesus. Satan will be unleashed again, and then Jesus will come and judge the dead, and then there will be a new heavens and a new earth and a resurrection reality, and that'll be the end of the old age as we know it. And so if you read through the book of Revelation sequentially, you have a predictive understanding of the book of Revelation. Now, by the way, Ladd breaks the futurist position into I forget his exact terminology, but it's like moderate futurist position and a radical futurist position. The latter being a dispensational understanding, the former being what is known as the historic pre-mill approach, where there is a millennium, but the church undergoes the tribulation leading up to the millennium. That's my own approach, by the way. But you can guess which one Ladd holds. Is he going to be the moderate or the radical? Just guess, you know. Anyway, I encourage you to read Ladd in that respect. If you understand that there's these different matrices, and you can see how different they are, the book of Revelation is largely done with. The book of Revelation is largely yet to come. The book of Revelation is true for all time. I mean, that's effectively the distinction that's going to happen here. Now, I can't resolve for you which approach you should use. But if you understand that there are those different approaches, and then you start reading about the book of Revelation, I would encourage you to read from several different perspectives there and see which one makes sense to you. Okay? That's all I can really say at this stage of that. I can say that I find the historicists to have some major problems. Because it's difficult to fit the book of Revelation into the history of the church, and it almost always feels like somebody's kind of forcing it in there. So I don't think that's very likely. Let me tell you where I come from personally, just so you have some sense, all right? There are aspects of, for instance, the description of the beast in Revelation that really is parallel to Rome in the first century. There's a mention of seven horns, for instance. Well, there's seven mountains that surround Rome. And so there's a lot of kind of interesting correlations that can be made there. The problem is that the book of Revelation, if it's a preterist book, doesn't do a very good job of explaining the events leading up to AD 70. And takes you in weird directions that just don't seem to pan out with what we understand from history. So I don't think that it seems to be a preterist book. So I would be left with the idealist or the futurist position. The other issue that I find in the book of Revelation is that there is sequence that's involved in the book of Revelation, such that the beast is introduced, and then some of his colleagues, and then Babylon is introduced, and then Babylon is destroyed, the colleagues of the beast are destroyed, then the beast is destroyed, in that order. So there's an order and a shaping to the book of Revelation that's very well crafted and put together. But that order and shaping also assumes a temporal sequence in the introduction of the characters, which makes it more difficult for me to understand it in kind of an idealist kind of thematic way. It seems to me that it's pushing you to an understanding of kind of temporal sequence. So that's just where I come from on this. And you'll see Ladd arguing these things too. All right. Now, however, regardless of which one of these approaches you take, the best thing to see with the book of Revelation is you got to stay with the big picture. Okay? The big picture, you got to look at the forest and not just the trees. Because the big picture is the kind of thing that any 10-year-old could read through the book of Revelation and tell you fundamentally what it's about. They would come out and they would say, wow, there's all these beasts and there's these dragons and all this kind of stuff. And you'd ask them, well, what's it trying to say to us? And they would say, well, I guess it's trying to say to us that the church is going to face a lot of stuff and it needs to endure. And you're like, I think they got the book. That's what the book's about. And so when you read through the book of Revelation, what I would really encourage you to do is to find yourself a whole hour where you go from chapter 1 to chapter 22, and there's a lot of times when you're just mystified, like, who in the world, what in the world? But you get the big picture when you get to the end. And if you get that, then I think fundamentally the book of Revelation has accomplished in you what John has set out for it to do. So stay with the big picture, and you'll be a lot more comfortable with reading the book itself. Okay. Any questions on that?
Revelations will be on the test.
It certainly can be. We've covered it in class now. The very practical question in the back.